After we were there the second day, I was passing out leaflets, and I was dressed in my clerical garb as I am now. And as I was giving out leaflets, I noticed an individual coming up the street, and this woman, when she reached me, I said, "Here, madam, would you like one of our leaflets?" And she hit me with her purse. And like an idiot, I didn't stop. I said, "Madam, are you sure you don't want one of my leaflets?" So she hit me again. And she said, "If I had my way, all of you perverted individuals would be locked up in the jail and the key thrown away."
This is an American minister preaching to his congregation. He's telling of an incident that occurred during a demonstration he was involved in. His name is Troy Perry, and he's a homosexual. His congregation consists of homosexuals, and those in the demonstration were homosexuals. A matter of concern, it would seem, to the lady with the purse. Mr. Perry and his fellow homosexuals make up an estimated 5% of the American male population. New Zealand figures would probably be comparable. In most states of America, homosexual acts are punishable by law. And as far as men are concerned, so too are they in New Zealand. In this program, we'll examine male homosexuality, the problems faced as well as posed by the homosexual, with particular reference to the New Zealand law as it is now, and as reformers would have it. It's worth bearing in mind that homosexuality isn't a recent phenomenon. Research would indicate that in most primitive societies, as well as the earlier advanced civilizations, some form of homosexual activity was considered normal and acceptable. Sometimes it's found linked with religious beliefs and ceremonials. Noted anthropologist Sir Richard Burton stated that in Rome, as in Egypt, the temples of Isis were centers of sodomy, and similar practices took place among grand priestly castes from Mesopotamia to Mexico and Peru. Dr. Daniel West, in his now classic book on the subject, states that in classical Greece, homosexuality achieved social recognition as an acceptable form of love between males, most appropriate between youths and older men who could instruct them in the manly virtues. Writers pictured homosexual love as a lofty passion that raised men above themselves. In his Symposium, Plato wrote,
"And if there were only some way of contriving that a state or army should be made up of lovers and their loves, they would be the very best governors of their own city, abstaining from all dishonor and emulating one another in honor. And when fighting at each other's side, although a mere handful, they would overcome the world. The veriest coward would become an inspired hero, equal to the bravest at such a time. Love would inspire him."
The Spartan and Theban armies were organized on just this theory. Study of the sexual habits of Greece and Rome serves to confirm that homosexual instincts soon make themselves apparent whenever they are given a free rein. While the history of British civilization shows that a severely repressive attitude, on the other hand, has consistently failed to eradicate them. Even in periods when detection meant death, the practice was known to be widespread, says Daniel West.
"A curious little 18th century book entitled Plain Reasons for the Growth of Sodomy in England shows that even in those days, homosexuality was considered a social problem. The author attributes the prevalence of the vice to the mollycoddling of boys and the cultivation of effeminate habits by young men. He deplores the custom of sending young boys to kindergartens run by women. He thinks the young men's habits of foppish attire, continental manners, indolence, and tea drinking breed milksops. The influence of the Italian opera he considers particularly pernicious, for it is well known, he alleges, that sodomy is thought a trivial matter in Italy, so that no sooner does a stranger set foot in Rome than the procurers rush to ask if he wants a woman or a young man."
The 19th century was full of scandals, from the suicide of the foreign minister Castlereagh because of the fear of his being denounced, to the imprisonment of the playwright Oscar Wilde after three sensational trials. Commenting on the Wilde affair, the famous newspaper editor W.T. Stead made this observation.
should everyone found guilty of Oscar Wilde's crime be imprisoned, there'd be a very surprising emigration from Eton, Harrow, Rugby and Winchester to the jails of Pentonville and Holloway.
Oscar Wilde was convicted under Britain's Criminal Law Amendment Act, which was passed by a thinly attended House of Commons on the eve of a parliamentary recess in 1885. It provided for a maximum penalty of 2 years' imprisonment, with or without hard labour, for what it termed gross indecency between males. Wilde was given the full penalty. Had he but known it, he got off lightly, for under the criminal code introduced in New Zealand in 1893, sodomy became punishable by life imprisonment with hard labour plus one, two or three floggings, depending on the offender's age. And for indecent assault on a male by a male, 10 years with hard labour, again with one, two or three floggings. The flogging provisions were deleted in 1941, the hard labour provisions in 1954. The last amendment was made in 1961 when the new Crimes Act laid down a maximum penalty of 10 years jail for indecency by a man on a boy under 16, 5 years for indecency between males over 16, 14 years for sodomy on a female or boy under 16, and 7 years for sodomy in any other case. But even in 1961, there were many who felt that in continuing to treat homosexuality as a criminal offence, Parliament was not taking into sufficient account the growing number of arguments, such as those embodied in Britain's Wolfenden Report of the late 50s, in favour of legalising homosexuality between consenting male adults, with provision being retained for the protection of minors. And it was to promote this very aim that the New Zealand Homosexual Law Reform Society was founded in 1967. The immediate past president of the society, Professor J.H. Robb, gives his view of the society's objectives.
Well, in effect, we would like to see homosexuals put in pretty much the same situation as heterosexuals. That, in other words, have their private behaviour regarded as their own affair, and for the law to take cognizance only of those aspects of their behaviour which makes its impact directly on the rest of society.
But of course the traditional Western view of homosexuality is that it's a perversion. I wonder, in the light of the fact that these views are still probably fairly widely held, if we're not being a little premature in seeking law reform.
No, I don't think we're being premature. I think this is a problem that the law reformers, of course, have got to deal with. But I think it's becoming more and more widely recognised that the condition of homosexuality is something over which the individual homosexual has no control. It's of course true that it's possible for the homosexual to not to take part in sexual activity, just as it's possible for a heterosexual not to take part in sexual activity, but not a very easy restraint for either to exercise.
Does the law as it stands really pose many problems? I mean, the incidence of prosecution these days is pretty minimal. Would a law change really make any difference in the day-to-day life of a homosexual?
It'd make a great deal more in the day-to-day life of the homosexual than it will in the court figures. It should certainly take a great burden of anxiety off homosexuals, and it should certainly make a good many homosexuals with real ability and with qualities that they can make use of in society, it should make many of them much more willing to take a more active part in the life of society without feeling that they're going to bring attention on themselves. Society would be demonstrating a degree of tolerance to a set of its members who, as I must emphasize again, have not chosen to be the way they are, who simply have no control over their condition and who have a great burden placed on them in terms of the kind of behaviour relating to their condition which is allowed by society.
No control over their condition. If what Professor Robb says is true, what does, in fact, cause a person to be homosexual? Theories abound, but leaving aside tea drinking and Italian opera, they appear to fall into two basic categories. First, those which contend that there's a congenital cause, that is, one has a genetic homosexual predisposition, and second, those which contend that homosexuality is a psychological effect of external circumstances operating during the impressionable years of one's life. To date, the latter seem to have enjoyed greater acceptance. Dr. Anthony Taylor, Professor of Psychology at Victoria University, is one who is sceptical about congenital theories.
Oh no, there's no evidence, no substantial evidence, that homosexuality is the result of defective genes or hormonal imbalance.
Well, what can we say then with any degree of definition about what causes homosexuality?
I suppose we can say that the most reliable evidence comes from defective parental child relationships, the provision of inadequate parental models. If you're a male, you need something of a strong, kind, courteous, an admirable father, not necessarily fulfilling the masculine prototype, you know, of the male chauvinist pig by any means. You need a mother who can respect you for what you are, a male, and not again try to distort and twist your own psychological inclinations and your social behaviour to fit an image that she has. There are a surprising number of men who've been manipulated into acting in curiously effeminate ways.
But we can't generalise that all homosexuals are effeminate,
oh,
can
no.
we?
Oh no, we cannot. For those, the group that I've just mentioned are those in which there is a clear-cut a distortion of parent-child images and identifications.
Are these the people who come under the label of transvestites?
Well, the sexual confusion is marked, but they need not only be transvestites. Some people who are very sexually confused do get into such extreme states of emotional disorder that they fall into the category of neurotics. Others are transvestites, others are transsexuals, and others are hermaphrodites. So you pick one of them, and you see, one of the four possible groups that occur to me at the moment.
Well, would it be true to assume that the behaviour of transvestites, which is by its very nature more conspicuous, has led to a colouring of the public's attitude towards homosexuals? Have they confused sort of cross-sexualism with the homosexuality?
Well, I don't know about the public. We've got to take care not to malign the public. There's far more good strength and good sense on such matters than many of us so-called experts allow them to have. We don't give them credence for the good judgment that's often there. The members of the public are far more tolerant of deviations and various small groups. It's only when, for a variety of reasons best known to themselves, people get offended and incensed that they then act sort of legally and try to invoke the majesty of the law to suppress certain groups, and in so doing they make the lot of these minority groups far worse than it need be, and they accentuate a problem.
Is it revulsion at what people imagine are the things homosexuals do, or is it an acquired prejudice, or is it perhaps the fear of one's own inner tendencies?
Well, I'd put my money essentially on this, on the latter, a fear of one's own inner tendencies, which then makes you inveigh against anyone who would ask that the matter be looked at soberly and objectively. It's, in my experience, a curious group of people who will not can hardly bear to mention the word. After all, I do recall having a book review discussion on NZBC some 12 years ago when I was told that the word homosexual should not be mentioned. I'm puzzled by the delay now, 15 years of delay since the Wolfenden Report, 1957, that came through. I would think that in the past there was more timidity on the part of our political leaders than there is today, and I'm quite confident that those who are in tune with a wider group of people in the community cannot but reach the conclusion that there's good sense in the homosexual law reform movement that's now acting very soberly and, in my view, very properly in getting this matter dealt with.
Others who play a prominent part in getting this matter dealt with are the police. It is they, of course, whose job it is to enforce the law. And in so doing, if the impressions of Detective Chief Inspector John Stevenson are any indication, they form a rather poor picture of homosexuals. Not that the police, according to him, actively set about tracking them down to bring them to court. In fact, Mr. Stevenson claims, if a homosexual is being blackmailed and goes to them seeking protection from the blackmailer, he will be given that protection by the police.
I have given this undertaking myself, and I know of no police officer who wouldn't do so. We regard blackmail as a serious crime, and we are quite prepared to offer the immunity that we can in order to see that a more serious crime is brought to book.
Could we talk a little about homosexual prostitution? It's something that's been in the news fairly recently. Is the incidence of this high, and how do the police deal with it?
Yes, it is. It forms a difficulty for the police. We have charged some of these with offences under our Police Offences Act of being idle and disorderly. But stemming from homosexual prostitution comes a very real problem, and that's that of robbery. And very often those who are concerned about homosexual reform consider that they see homosexuals as the victims of robbery. Well, what we're getting is an alarming incidence where homosexuals, transvestites, are being used to entice people away from drinking places and other places of resort in our cities. And they, in fact, are committing the robberies. And this is our experience. Wherever you have a particular perversion, it seems to attract other forms of crime, and we get homicides stemming from the same source.
Do you really believe, though, that this propensity for crime is inherent in homosexuality itself?
I think it is, and I can't see how any alleviation, as far as the law is concerned, is going to materially help this.
I wonder if it's a little unfair that we should judge homosexuals by the attitude of a few who flaunt themselves.
I'm not judging them at all. I'm merely telling you of my experiences in the practical field, and these are those that we have a great deal of difficulty with. The couple who are said to have a long-standing homosexual relationship, something in the kin to the movie, The Odd Couple, they're fairly rare. I find that the general trend among homosexuals, and I've known them over a wide area and for a long time, is that they seek titillation of an appetite by seeking new fields very often. And the places of homosexual resort that we know exist in our bigger cities seem to cater for this appetite to look for new pairings and new partners.
Well, there's one aspect of police behaviour, as far as these resorts are concerned, that does seem just a little seamy, and that is policemen will go into a public toilet and plant themselves there to tempt a homosexual who comes on the lookout, on the hunt, as you would say. Do you feel entirely happy about this way of going about things?
Well, I'd be concerned if I thought that police were setting up to entrap deliberately, and I know of about five or six cases in my experience in the last 4 or 5 years where young policemen in plain clothes, and these are detectives who have been working for me, have had a positive homosexual approach made to them when they were using the toilet for their own legitimate purposes and with no thought of any planting at all. And I know from the complaints that we receive from members of the public that there are toilets in every town where homosexuals hunt, and they are likely to have this approach. Now, if a policeman happens to be present and he has this type of approach made to him, then fine. I consider that we're entitled to bring the offender. This is the hunting homosexual that I'm talking about, because he obviously would make the same approach to any young male who was using the toilet.
But do the police plant themselves as an act of policy?
No, not at all.
Any law prohibiting a certain form of conduct has an implied moral basis, and the moral opposition to homosexuality seems to have been based, over the past 1,000 years, on grounds of religion, specifically Jewish and Christian beliefs. Father Charles Harrison will comment on this shortly, but first, let's pursue the Reverend Troy Perry's argument with his lady protagonist a little further.
And she said, if I had my way, all of you perverted individuals would be locked up in the jail and the key thrown away. I said, madam, you know something, that's a wonderful Christian attitude you have. She said, do you know what the Old Testament says? I said, I sure do. It says it's a sin for a woman to wear a red dress, a man to wear cotton shirt and woolen pants together, to eat shrimp, oysters, or lobster, your steak too rare. She said, that's not what I'm talking about. I said, I know it's not. You're going to tell me that Moses didn't like homosexuals, and I'm going to agree. But he didn't like women wearing red dresses, men wearing cotton shirt and woolen pants, eating shrimp, oysters, or lobster, your steak too rare. And somehow, the Christian church has forgotten all about that. She said, well, she said, do you know what the Apostle Paul said? I said, I sure do. He said, for women to be silent, not to speak. She said, that's still not what I mean. I said, I know it's not. You're going to tell me in Romans 1, 26 through 28, and 1 Corinthians 6 and 9, and in 1 Timothy that Paul didn't like homosexuals, and I'm going to agree. He didn't, but he didn't like women. He didn't like long-haired guys or short-haired women. He didn't care about slave one way or the other. And yet the Christian church here again has conveniently forgotten about that. And I said, I'm not saved by the blood of Paul, and I'm not saved by the blood of Moses. I'm saved by the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ.
Father Harrison, what the Reverend Troy Perry seems to be saying here is that while it may be true that sanction for homosexuality and law reform may not be possible to get from St. Paul or Moses, it is possible to get the sanction from Christ. Is this so?
Not so. The difference between both Paul and Moses on the one hand and Christ on the other is that the first two laid down rules. The other didn't. He laid down principles. When you lay down rules, they're always circumscribed by the age and the place in which you lay them down. When you lay down a principle, it stands the test of time and is of universal application, so that the Christian now has to say, in following Christ, which is what I understood Mr. Perry to be saying, he rises above mere legalistic formulations and says, I will apply a law, namely of love, to the circumstances of my day, and it is in those terms that the question should be asked of the modern Christian.
All right, well, if we apply this principle of universal love, what stand does it lead us to on the subject of homosexuality?
It leads us to a universal compassion,
not only to the homosexual, but to all the people affected by the homosexual, including, for instance, little boys.
Well, what will this mean in terms of law reform?
It would mean that you could permit a degree of liberalising, provided you could guarantee the terms in which the law reformists in this area ask for it, namely, that it shall be between consenting adults in private. But my fear is that if you did give that liberalising, you might fall into two errors. First, you might be taken to be liberalising more than you had actually said. You might be going along with a general permissiveness. That is to say, you might open the door to pederasty when you didn't mean to open it. And secondly, you might be giving the impression that you regarded homosexuality as a norm. Now, it is not a norm. Heterosexuality is the norm, and there is a discipline to be required of the treatment of all human sexuality, homo, hetero, even bestiality. I'm afraid that if you do this thing, you might be on quite sound Christian grounds in doing it, but what you are taken to be doing might be quite a different kettle of fish.
Father Charles Harrison is giving his individual view as an Anglican priest. His reservations are shared by Father Totman of the Roman Catholic Church, who feels that homosexuality is definitely a legitimate object of judicial concern.
I feel personally, and I think I'd have a great deal of support in my church for saying that the law should regard homosexuality as an abnormality. It shouldn't treat it as something which is lawful or legitimate behaviour. Now, I believe that in this we're supported by the great number of people in the community. The community as such, I think, would regard homosexuality as an abnormality. And for that reason, the civil law should uphold that and state it to be an abnormal state.
But is there any biblical authority for specifically making homosexual conduct punishable by civil law?
I wouldn't think so. And I don't think that homosexual conduct should be punishable, not necessarily punishable. I think it's in this area that we could agree with the reform of the law. Not changing the law itself, not making homosexuality legal, because I think that would be a mistake, and I'd be against the legalising of homosexuality as such. Now, the present sanction for homosexuality is jail. That is not always the answer. In fact, in very few cases does it do any good. It doesn't do any good to the victim, and it certainly doesn't do society any good. It could well confirm a victim in his abnormality. And so we would agree that the sanction to the law should be changed. I would like to see something substituted for a jail penalty. For example, if we could have treatment for the homosexual substituted for the penalty that now applies. But if a person can't be re-educated, and if they can't be brought out of this homosexual groove into which they've got, they can be taught to live a normal, happy and moral life.
You mean a chaste life?
Yes, yes, even a chaste life. Of course, this requires continuing care and assistance and a great deal of goodwill and cooperation on the part of the person afflicted with this abnormality.
Patience and goodwill. Father Totman would be supported in this by the Dean of St. Paul's Anglican Cathedral in Wellington. As a counsellor for the Samaritan Service, Dean Hurst encounters many people with a homosexual problem. He's a supporter of law reform, believing that while homosexuality is not an exercise to be encouraged, neither should it be treated with blind contempt. Well, Dean, you move a lot around the community and you've come into contact, as you've just said, with a lot of homosexuals. I wonder how much prejudice you strike among the so-called normal community against homosexuals. Is there a lot still?
Oh, yes, there's a lot.
What form does it take?
It takes the form of despising them and wanting to reject them. And I think most of the opposition to any law reform will come from those who feel so badly about homosexuals that they either want to close them up or castrate them or lash them within an inch of their lives. You know, all the old blah that is so much of the sort of old school attitude to these things. And I think the people will use the Bible against law revision. They will use the old school tie attitude. They will use the appellation disgusted without trying to understand what's wrong with these unfortunate people.
Where does this attitude stem from, do you think?
I think it's a psychological attitude caused by the sort of feeling there, but for the grace of God, go I. I hope never to be caught up in a homosexual act or a sexual offense or anything that can be called dirty. And I feel that anybody who acts like this is beyond the pale. I think that's the psychological attitude. Now, I could have thought like this, I'm sure I probably did most of my life, until I began to realize that the people who are abnormal are the people who need all the help and guidance we can give them if they're prepared to submit to it. You know, that is, if they'll come and talk to us and present their problem and let's help. Because they need help, just as the alcoholic needs help, just as the drug addict needs help. When they're hooked on this particular thing, then they need help to get off it. It's no good shunning them, putting them in prison, trying to take any shortcut. It requires hours and hours of honest, diligent work with them.
But in the eyes of an increasing number of homosexuals themselves, such concern is misplaced. To them, their homosexuality is not an illness, not a disorder, certainly not a perversion, and in fact not even a problem, except insofar as the law and society's attitudes are concerned. And therefore, they claim for themselves the right to live their own lives free from judicial intervention and without having to incur the hostility of the community in which they form a sizable minority. I talked to three such young male homosexuals, Michael, Paul, and Laurie, and quoted them Detective Chief Inspector Stevenson's statement that there is inherent in the makeup of the homosexual a propensity for crime.
Well, I would say it's complete and utter rubbish, and I don't think he can know what he's talking about. He's basing that information on a sample of the case that come before him, and that's really only the tip of the iceberg. There are goodness knows how many others who don't come into this category, and to suggest from this data that they're all the same is complete nonsense.
I would suggest that the majority of the crimes are performed by heterosexuals, and probably because of the heterosexual stimulus. I don't think you can single out one's sexuality as being a causal nature of their criminal activity.
I certainly agree with Paul on that. I can't see why the police officer should base statements on the grounds of a person's sexuality. It seems quite irrelevant.
Another thing that tends to blot the image of the homosexual world somewhat is the bitchiness that is popularly supposed through films like Boys in the Band to exist among homosexuals. Does it, in fact?
Oh, you see it sometimes, but in very small doses. It's certainly not indicative of homosexuals as a group.
I think it's just part of the popular stereotype. It doesn't apply to more than a very small section.
Paul?
Yes, I'd agree. It's part of the stereotype, part of the myth. And I feel that a lot of people, particularly young people, when they're not sure how to behave, they'll fall into these stereotype limits of behaviour simply because that's what they have been taught to do. But very soon they then find their own personalities
Well, there's a lot of speculation as to what causes homosexuality. Do you yourselves as homosexuals feel that it's something you were born with, or did you acquire it?
Well, I think I acquired it. And looking back on my past life, I think I can point to various incidents or passages of time wherein this trait was developed. But I don't think it's something which is genetic in any way.
I have no doubt at all that I acquired it.
I disagree completely. I think that it's a complete interplay between a genetic heritage and one's environment. I can't personally look back and say I had this genetic heritage. It's impossible for me to do so. But just by the research that has been done, it tends to show that there's some other factor other than environment.
What about our classical textbook situation of the dominant mother and the weak or absent father? How do you feel about that?
Well, this is, I think, only a specific case. It does occur, but I don't think it's a general rule. I don't think you can make a general universal rule for any causal factor, simply because I believe it is genetic as well as environmental. Environments differ so radically. Genetics differ very radically. You can't have it a universal law.
I think it would apply far more than any other cause, because there has been a very high correlation shown between this particular aspect and homosexuality. It's definitely a major cause.
I can only fall back on people I've spoken to, and I'd say consensus there is that in some cases it occurs, in other cases it doesn't. I can't see any general pattern emerging.
It's also very difficult because most of the case studies that have been done, particularly the ones that have brought out this the dominant mother bit, have been done on people who are either inmates of a asylum, people who have gone personally to a psychiatrist because they have problems, or criminals, and this is only a very small, very non-random group, so there must be biases, and it's quite probable that the psychiatric reports, the problems those people have stem from having a dominant mother, not because they're homosexual.
Do you think there's perhaps a tendency on the part of society to think, when thinking of homosexuals, more or less exclusively in terms of their sexual activities?
Yes, definitely, which makes me very angry because instead of looking at other people as people, they look at them as categories of this man's sexuality, this woman's sexuality. Women suffer by being treated as sex objects. Male homosexuals suffer as being called homosexuals, and yet it's a very, very minor part of one's life. I mean, most of one's life isn't spent on actual sexual activity.
Yes, I would agree with that. The definition of a homosexual is someone with the ability to love another member of one's sex, and sex is sort of incidental to this. It's the love which is the important part, which people seem to ignore.
I've been highly amused when I've gone out to address groups. I've been speaking about homosexuals as people, and when question time comes, people are mainly interested in my private sex life, and they've missed the whole point of the address.
If some means were devised tomorrow whereby you could become instantly heterosexual, would you?
No.
No, definitely not.
No, not at all.
Well, why not?
Well, I'm completely happy the way I am. I don't think I'm sick, diseased, or in any way affected. I consider myself to be a person. I consider that I have something to contribute. And what I happen to do in bed is quite immaterial.
Yes, I'm quite happy and well-adjusted to what I am. I have no feelings at all there's something wrong with me, because I know there's not.
Yes, I find that my sex behaviour is only a tiny part of my life, but it's also an integral part of my life. If that was changed, it would affect all the rest of my life and all the rest of my behaviour, which means I would have to once again learn all about myself and how to live. I don't think that a change is necessary.
And although such a change is implicitly required of Paul by the present law, indications would suggest that it's going to be the law itself that changes. Recent annual conferences of both the Labour and National parties have passed remits in favour of homosexual law reform, while the new Minister of Justice, Dr. Martin Finlay, has stated his willingness to support a private member's bill along these lines in Parliament. And although there haven't yet been any volunteers, it would seem, for better or for worse, to be only a matter of time.